In this session and the next few, who knows, one, two, I'm not sure how many we'll take, at least three. We're going to be talking about general social norms. This is going to be largely winding up our series on a radically Christian counterculture. We've talked about specific categories that are essential to consider when it comes to what a culture is made of. It's made of its families, it's made of its economic theories and behaviors. It's made of its gender roles and things. That's how cultures are exhibited and identified. But we've just talked about the specific categories. Now I want to just sort of pick up fragments in the next few lectures and talk about some general social behaviors that are related to distinctly Christian life, and especially those which may in some instances run up against the dominant culture, where a Christian would look different, would behave differently. Now, we don't want to behave differently just to be different. We want to behave differently insofar as faithfulness to the Word of God requires it, and we want to do so without apology and without embarrassment. Even if we are outnumbered 1,000 to 1, even in the church, we may be outnumbered 1,000 to 1, but if we stand for the things of God, guess what? His truth endures forever. Whatever the rest of the people are into, that's a fad. It'll pass too. But if you stand for the eternal norms laid out in Scripture, if the church would do this, if a larger number, if an increasing body like leaven in a lump of dough would begin to carry out these norms, there would emerge a cultural phenomenon that would be a force to be reckoned with in the spiritual realm and in the social and cultural realm. That's what I'm hoping may eventually happen, though we live at a day when we may not see much in terms of manifestation. We are in the generation that must sow the seeds for a future generation's experience so that the truth of Christianity might not be compromised forever, but that we can return to it and our children perhaps will have a purer, more genuine Christian life. At least the church to which they belong may be more distinctly Christian and less distinctly worldly. Now, when we talk about social norms, there's two broad categories. And of course, as is my way, I will subdivide these broad categories into smaller. But the broad categories are that of private behavior, that is, customs and norms and values and so forth relating to private behavior. And then there are those that have to do with public behavior. And those are really the two categories that exist in general social norms. So let's talk first about privacy, the private behavior. This is something that there aren't as many subpoints on that I want to get into. Perhaps there could be more, but I want to really spend more of our time talking about the public behavior of the Christian. But we need to realize, of course, that public behavior, if it is distinctly Christian, cannot be pleasing to God unless it is accompanied by pleasing private behavior. In other words, what is done when you are alone is that which defines your character. What you do in public is not always definitive because people can fake it in public. But the way you order your private life is the root from which your behavior comes. And if the root is corrupt, the behavior may not be just as corrupt outwardly as far as the world sees it, but it will be as corrupt as far as God is concerned. You can do the right thing publicly, but with the wrong motive, and it would be an abomination to God. Jesus gave examples of this, of course, in the Sermon on the Mount, in Matthew chapter 6, where he talked about when you give your alms, don't be like the hypocrites who do it to be seen by men. They have their reward. When you pray, don't be like the hypocrites who do it on the street corners so that everyone will hear how pious they are. They have their reward. When you fast, don't disfigure your face and groan and travail so that everyone will notice that you're fasting and admire you. The hypocrites do this and they have their reward. What is their reward? Their reward is the one they're seeking, the approval of man. The reward they're not receiving is the approval of God. Jesus says, if you do this as they do, you will have no reward from your heavenly Father. Now, Christians who are thinking like Christians are not concerned about the approval of man. I need to modify that. Everyone by nature is in measure concerned about the approval of man. Rejection is not pleasant, no matter how spiritual you are. It is possible, however, for some people almost to thrive, maybe almost unhealthily, on rejection. Jehovah's Witnesses, I think, may be of this category. You know, the more firmly you reject them, the more they feel vindicated, because they believe, of course, we are the true elect and we are the true saints, and we expect Babylon to hate Zion. You know, I mean, obviously we expect the world to hate Christians, and therefore it is a flattery to us if the world hates us. Well, there is a sense in which that can be true. It can just be taken to an extreme. The insults of some people are indeed compliments. Jesus said, "Woe unto you when all men speak well of you," in Luke chapter 6. He said, "Blessed are you when men persecute you and revile you and cast out your name as evil." So there is a place to embrace as a compliment rejection from people who reject God. But at the same time, it is not our place to be as offensive as possible so that we offend and are rejected by as many people as possible, so that we can feel vindicated by our own remnant righteousness. The fact of the matter is, it is our task to be salt and light and leaven and to have an impact on society. And we remember that there were periods of time in the infant church that says they had favor with all the people. You know, the world is fickle. When they see righteousness, true righteousness, sometimes they'll say, "Wow, that's really good." Other times they'll change their mind. They'll start getting a little convicted. "Hey, that's really, we got to stamp that out." And so there's alternately persecution and admiration for righteousness. But when the church is compromised and follows world norms rather than biblical norms, it receives neither real persecution nor any real admiration. It just is there and no one takes it seriously. It's just sort of an annoyance, like background noise. You know, the church is there. People get used to the fact that it's there, like Muzak in the shopping center. You know, once in a while you might catch a tune you recognize, but most of the time it's just going on. You don't even notice it's there. And a church that is so compromised, that has no character of its own, salt that has no savor, is not going to have any impact for good or evil. A church that is actively persecuted can have, if it's for faithfulness to Christ, can be as pleased as the church that is actively admired and sought after because it clearly has the wisdom of God. The church will have ebbs and flows in the favor of man in its history if it is faithful. If it is unfaithful, eventually it's just kind of background noise. That's what the church is in Western culture for the most part today. In fact, it's a noise that's becoming very faint because it just blends in with the sounds all around it anyway. Let's talk about the private behavior of the Christian. Now, I'm not going to talk about secret motives and things like that. I made allusion to that when I talked about Jesus and the Pharisees. You know, your motive should be good. A good thing outwardly done for bad motives is a bad thing. It's the motive that makes a thing good or bad. Of course, the thing itself also can be bad. You can do a bad thing with good motives and it's still a bad thing. But if you do a good thing with bad motives, it's bad. It's easier to be bad than good. Let's put it that way. There's more things bad than there are good. There's only one thing good, and that's God only, Jesus said. And therefore, the only way to really be pleasing to God, to be a good person, to be a good people, is to please God in all things. That begins in our private behavior, and it extends to our public behavior. Let's talk first about private behavior. There's three issues I'd like to discuss in this general category. One is the whole issue of personal privacy. You know, your own space, having space, the privacy issue. A second is the leisure issue, which really boils down to the question of stewardship of time, whether time is being used well. And then there is the issue of entertainment, how you entertain yourself. This is a matter of stewardship of your mind. People might think that the issues of privacy and leisure and entertainment are secular issues, that they really have nothing to do with being a Christian or not being a Christian, that there would not be distinctly Christian things to say about these. But of course there are. Because, as I said, leisure is a stewardship of time. That time belongs to God. How are you stewarding it? Entertainment, it has to do with the stewardship of your mind. Your mind belongs to God. How are you stewarding it? Every steward will give account of himself to his owner. And it is best to have stewarded well so that he can say, "Well done, good and faithful servant. You've been faithful in a few things. I'll now make you ruler over many things." But the first issue about private behavior is the whole subject of privacy. Is privacy good? Is it good to be a private person? Or is that kind of antisocial? Well, it's neither a black or a white here. privacy is appropriate and necessary at times, and not so appropriate at other times. The hermit of the 3rd and 4th century, the hermits who went out into the deserts and the caves and sat on tops of flagpoles for 30 years and had their disciples bring their food up to them in buckets and take their feces down in the same buckets, these men thought they were exceedingly spiritual because they were totally isolated from all the corrupting influence of the world. That privacy, I mean, they were the epitome of privacy. Private persons. Some took vows of silence, the Trappist monks, they don't take a vow of silence, they don't speak at all. And this is, you know, being an extremely private person, keeping it to yourself, avoiding crowds and so forth. This is not like Jesus. Now, there was a godly person in the New Testament who was relatively private. That was John the Baptist. And John the Baptist, of course, lived out away from society, lived in the wilderness. He ate bugs and honey and stuff. But he wasn't entirely private. He came out and he was a voice, too. He came out and spoke to society. But his life was full of privacy. Jesus also was a man who appreciated privacy, though he was not as given over to privacy as he was given over to people. He was a very sociable person. He was accompanied by crowds. He went to feasts and parties. He was not entirely private, but we do find Jesus putting a premium on his private times where he could get alone with God. Privacy is a necessary part of spiritual well-being. And there are some structures in our modern culture that make privacy very difficult. And it makes it necessary for Christians to make time for privacy. A lot of people say, I just haven't found the time to get around to reading my Bible. I haven't found any time to pray. Well, you don't find it, you make it. There are some societies where privacy comes readily, where there's not large crowds, where there's a lot of working alone in solitary and so forth, and where privacy is a natural thing. But in a society like ours, there's many structures in our culture that make privacy elusive, where the Christian must rise up and take charge of his time and say, I must obtain, I must make time, I must acquire the time for time alone with God. Now, we live, the populations of the modern world live largely in metropolitan situations, in urban and suburban areas. I have seen the statistics years ago. I don't remember them, so I won't try to quote them. But there has been an increase over the years of the percentage of the world population that lives in population centers. You know, 100 years ago, you know, some small percentage, you know, maybe 10%, I forget what it would be, something like that, of the human population lived in cities. Maybe 5%, 10%, some small percentage 100 years ago. Today, that figure is way up there. And I could be overly conservative in saying this, but it's something like 75% to 80, if not more. Some huge percentage of the population lives in condensed, compressed population areas. And you know what? The Bible doesn't say very positive things about cities. You ever notice the first city was built in rebellion against God? The first builder of a city was Cain. He built a city for his son and named it after his son. The next city we read about being built was Babel, built by Nimrod. And for the most part, cities have their beginnings as an attempt to violate the plan of God. God did not tell people to congregate in cities. He said, be fruitful, multiply, and fill the earth. There are many today who say the earth is overpopulated. And most people believe it. Do you know why? They live in cities. And cities are definitely overpopulated. All one needs to do is take a driving trip across the United States to know the United States is certainly not overpopulated. You can drive days through sparsely populated, you know, areas. You go to Alaska, there are some countries that are disproportionately overpopulated. But the world itself as a whole is not overpopulated, not in the least. It has been said that if you took all the people on the planet at this time and gave them each 300 square feet, you could put them all in half of the state of Alaska. The rest of the world could be used for growing food or whatever. I mean, we are not overpopulated. But the impression that the world is overpopulated is easy to foist on a gullible public because that public lives, for the most part, in overpopulated settings, namely cities. Now, I'm not saying that we should all move out of the cities. I'm saying this. We should be aware that while city life is the norm in our culture, it is not necessarily a norm biblically, and it is not bad for Christians to choose an alternative to it. You see, city life is preferred over rural life for the most part because of convenience. I know, because I've lived in the city. I was raised in L.A., or in the greater L.A. area. I was raised in the city. I live in the city most of my life. Today I live in a little homestead 10 miles out of town. It's a little more rural. I could get a lot more rural, but the fact is, just living 10 miles out of town, I realize how inconvenient it is compared to living in the city. When I lived here on this facility, in the middle of the night, I could walk across the street to 7-Eleven and get anything, almost anything I wanted. If they didn't have it, I could go down to another market that's open all night and get it. I could get gas in my car. I could do all kinds of things. Now, living 10 miles out of town, it's very inconvenient if my car runs out of gas. There's all kinds of problems, but there's some advantages too. In the city, privacy is extremely hard to find or even to obtain by force because there's just such a compacting of people. Now, I'm not saying there are no positive statements about cities in the Bible. Jerusalem, in many times in its history, was described in a very positive way. Beautiful for situation. The joy of the whole earth is Mount Zion in the sides of the north. The city of the great king. The church itself is likened to a glorious city in the book of Revelation, although I believe it's a symbolic description. But the point is, not all cities are bad, and therefore I'm not going to broad brush the whole issue of urban life as something Christians should stay away from. I am saying this, though, that many people assume that the conveniences of the city, the ability to make more money in the city, the ability to build a larger church because there's more people and more money can come into the church from that. City life almost seems like what must always be the norm, because how else are you going to make a good living? You move out onto a homestead, you're going to have to reduce your standard of living. You're going to not be able to run to the store for everything all the time. I mean, the convenience of city life is the allure of it. But everybody knows, too, that where the cities get a little too big, they get extremely dangerous. The main dangers of city life that most people are aware of is, of course, crime and gangs and that kind of stuff. But there's other dangers of it, too, of a spiritual sort, much more subtle. And that is simply the robbery of privacy. Privacy, a person should not be overly private, but a person cannot spiritually thrive if they're underly private. If a person does not ever get off alone on a regular basis. Jesus had a habit, since he was thronged with people wherever he went, even when he was out in the hillside. He didn't have to be in the city to be in a crowd. The crowds came to him. He would try to avoid them. He'd cross the Sea of Galilee by ship and they'd see where he was going. They'd run around the top and they'd be waiting for him when he got there. He spent a certain percentage of time trying to escape the crowds. But you know what? He saw the people as sheep without a shepherd, and when they caught up with him, he gave them his time and he ministered to them. He did not put his privacy and his desire, and even we might even say a need for privacy, he didn't put it above the needs of other people. But I will say this, that even in the times when he was thronged with crowds, he made sure he got private time with God. Jesus woke up a long time before day, customarily, a long time before the crowds were awake, probably hours before, and he went out to a private place to pray. We read this frequently in the life of Jesus. Isaiah, who obviously speaks the mind of God, almost seems to be against the modern urban phenomenon. I'm not entirely sure that's what he's criticizing, but I've always thought it sounded like it when I read his words in Isaiah chapter 5. Isaiah chapter 5 and verse 8 says, "Woe to those who join house to house, who add field to field, till there is no place where they may dwell alone in the midst of the land." Doesn't that sound like overdevelopment there? You know? People join house to house, join field to field. Now, I mean, if that was all it said, we might say that he's complaining against people who are building up, rich people acquiring all the property at the expense of the poor or whatever. But that's not what he's talking about. Although, essentially, cities do prosper at the expense of the poor, and that's why the inner city has such a huge poor population. You don't find huge poor population out on the farm, out in rural areas. There just aren't huge poor populations in the rural areas. But there are in the cities. But the thing here that is complained about is not the fact that this might be a case of rich men becoming the land barons and the feudal lords and all the poor people, you know, not having their own place or whatever. But rather, it says, where they may dwell, there remains no place where they may dwell alone in the midst of the land. Now, maybe that is they. Maybe that's the poor. Maybe land barons are buying up all the property and building the developments and joining house to house and just packing the buildings in. And maybe it is the poor from whom they're gaining the land that don't have a place to go anywhere. I'm not sure. But what I do see is a complaint against overdevelopment, which results in no privacy. So people don't have any place to go to be alone. And in a big city, you know, you can go to the library, and if it's relatively quiet, you can feel like you're alone. You can go to a city park if it's not overcrowded. There are places that they actually designate. Here's a place to go to be alone. But even there, you're not alone. But you can still sometimes, if it's quiet and you're not disturbed, you can sort of be alone. But the point is that we become, almost contented because we're acclimated to the culture we're raised in, to be content with that little privacy. In order to be alone, I often go to the library. Because I don't even live in the city, but even at home, there's a lot of activity. The phone's always ringing and the kids have demands and so forth. And for me to be alone, I can't be alone here. I could never work here at the school. The phone rings. As soon as I'm there, someone walks in and has questions for me or whatever, that's fine. That's what I'm here for. That's why sometimes I have to be not here. So I can do other things. I have to find privacy. And I'm not even an urban dweller. But it does seem that God expresses a concern that people should not so densely populate as to remove all opportunity for privacy. Remember, in biblical times, people didn't have cars. When Jesus walked from one end of Israel to the other, it was no more than about 70 miles. We'd get there in an hour on the highway. Jesus took a week to get there on foot. People would walk and we don't read of very many activities. If we read all the activities of Jesus that are recorded and say, what did he do the rest of the time? I mean, there's 39 days here of activity recorded, yet he ministered for 33 and a half years. What did he do the rest of the time? You know what he did most of the time? Walked. He probably walked a lot of the time, alone or with his disciples. And that was just a way of life for people who didn't live in the big city. There was a great deal of walking, and walking is a wonderful way to find privacy. In fact, even in the city, a lot of Christians find that the only time they really get to pray or to be alone with God is to just go take a walk. It's a great idea. To find some privacy is essential, or else you will spiritually dry up. Jesus himself could not afford to sacrifice his private time with God, and he was stronger than you are spiritually. And yet every day he'd sacrifice sleep in order to have that private time with God, because the daylight hours didn't afford him very much. Our lifestyle in the big city usually doesn't afford us very much either, and therefore we need to find it. By the way, I can remember a time when my time driving was a good time for prayer and fellowship and private time, because I don't like to listen to secular music. And I, frankly, don't like to listen to much of the Christian music either. So even though I had a radio, I often didn't have it on when I was driving. Then along came talk radio. And suddenly, every time I'm in the car, the radio's on. Not to music stations, but to talk stations. Every description of talk stations. And it never occurred to me at first the effect this was having on me. Every time I'd drive to town, every time I'd drive home, I was listening to a talk program. And I began to feel over the period of years that I was kind of drying up spiritually, and I couldn't figure it out. I was still reading my Bible at home. I was still teaching every day, reading the Bible. I mean, good heavens, I'm in the Word. I would still have time to pray. Sometimes my praying at home was kind of cut short because of not much privacy there, and sometimes I wasn't able to really get into it. I thought, well, what's going on? It feels like my spiritual life is waning. And a time came when I felt like the Lord kind of opened my eyes. You know what? You're listening to a lot of Rush Limbaugh. Now, Rush, I agree with some of the things he says, but he's not a Christian. He's not exactly edifying, and I'm not here to bury Rush Limbaugh. He's just quintessential of the talk show, entertainers. And I listen to a lot of these people. I still do, but I've now learned when I'm driving many times, at least a portion of the time, to turn off the radio. And boy, is that ever hard to do. When you're not accustomed to silence. You see, we're accustomed to stimulation. The stimulation of people. Sometimes my kids, if they haven't been to town for a few days, they just start like, they feel like they need to go out and see people. Well, this is perhaps something they do have a conditioned need for, but it's not an innate need. Yes, people need people, but the idea of going off and being alone for a couple of days shouldn't cause you to climb the walls. It's just that we are so accustomed to the stimulation of conversation, the stimulation of visual encounters with human beings, with the sounds and sights and the lights and the activities of life, that privacy almost gets boring. We don't know what to do. We almost feel uncomfortable. I turn off the talk show on my radio and I drive for a few minutes, I almost by nature reach over and turn it back on, not thinking about it, because I'm like, this is unnatural. It's unnatural not to have sound surrounding me. The sound of someone else's voice. And yet I catch myself and I'm like, wait a minute, I'm not going to turn that back on. If I always have the sound of another person's voice, when will I ever hear the voice of God? Because the sounds around me do call for my attention. When will God ever get my attention? And I think the Christian, as a stewardship, partially of his time, needs to obtain privacy, even if he is called to live in a place where privacy is elusive, because he might live in a densely populated area. I certainly do not think there's anything wrong at all with families moving out of the city. I don't say they must, but I'll tell you what. I never would have dreamed of moving out of the city. I love the city. I grew up in the city. It's my environment. I love people. I like to be around people. I like the stimulation. It's just, I was raised in it. When I'm not in the city, I feel like a fish out of water. But you know what? When I had children, I began to realize this is not the environment I want my children to be acclimated to. For one thing, the city today is different than the city 40 years ago when I was growing up. It's full of all kinds of danger, spiritual and otherwise, that I just as soon not have my children taken in by. It's also full of many distractions. I simply don't want my children being raised with all those distractions. And to some extent they still are, because they come to town with me and they get this, but we're weaning them a little. Now, I don't have to wean them entirely. I don't want them to get to a place where they don't want to be around people. But I want my children to get to a place, and I want me to be at the place where if I'm not around people, I know what to do with my brain. I know what to do with my attention. I know what to do with my energy. That I have a constructive use of privacy, of solitude. Solitude is a good thing. And yet, as I say, people can go too far in the area of privacy. People become antisocial. People can become, in their own mind, independent of society. And that is not a biblical concept. Even in the Old Testament, Solomon said in Ecclesiastes 4, and verses 9 through 11, two are better than one, because they have a good reward for their labor. For if they fall, one will lift up his companion. But woe to him who is alone when he falls, for he has no one to help him up. Again, if two lie down together, they will keep warm. But how can one be warm alone? Though one may be overpowered by another, two can withstand him. And a threefold cord is not quickly broken. There are advantages to not being alone. By the way, Jesus apparently understood this, because when he sent his disciples out to preach, he sent them out not alone, but by twos. There is safety in numbers. Now, what kind of safety? Well, he says there's a better reward for the labor. Two people working on one project can make light work and get a lot more done. He says that if one falls, the other can get him up. This is true spiritually as well. If you are alone and you fall into sin, who's going to get you back up? Well, God might. Or you might get yourself back up. But if you've got fellowship, if there's the accountability of society and fellowship, then there's someone there who can make sure you don't stay down, who can help you back up, who can make you accountable to get right again. If two lie together, they keep warm. How can one be warm alone? How can you keep your spiritual heat alone? Well, maybe you can. Some people can. But fervent fellowship with other people and social interaction of a positive sort keeps the flame, keeps igniting things. I love the fellowship I have with the brethren, because I almost never come away from it without getting re-inspired. In a way that I tend to cool down maybe after I'm too much alone. You dry up if you never get alone. But you can also cool down if you're always alone. There's got to be a balance here. An acknowledgement of the need for human society. If one is overpowered by another, two could resist him. You are involved in spiritual battle all the time. The devil's always hammering at you. If you're alone, you might be able to beat him. But if you've got a companion, you're much more likely to. This companionship, society of Christian fellowship, is an advantage. I know I travel a lot by airplane. I travel a lot. Unfortunately, I have to go without my family sometimes. I have now severely limited the number of times I'll travel without my family. Used to do it more, but as the family got bigger and so forth, I have tried to limit my travels largely to places I can go where I can take them, and only occasionally without them. There are still some places I feel called to go, but I don't feel it's impossible to take my family. I don't like this, though. I don't like to travel alone. There's times when I had to travel without my family, I took along another brother, you know, a second-year student from the school or something like that, just to go along. Because I find that spiritually, I am stronger when I'm not alone. When I go to an unusual environment, there's new stimuli, there's new temptations, there's new all kinds of things, new faces. There's also privacy, and privacy can work against you in a situation of temptation. Where there's no accountability, where there's total secrecy, where no one knows you, the devil can try to make you think you can get away with stuff that you don't even think about trying to get away with when you're around your friends and family. So I find that when possible, I like to take a brother along when I travel. I have found that I'm much more bold in my faith and outspoken in my faith when I have a brother with me. And it's not because I'm trying to impress him. It's just that I'm more bold. I mean, it's not like if I'm alone, I will never witness to someone, but when I'm with a brother, I witness to impress the brother. That's not at all the case. I just find it more natural to speak out about the Lord when I'm not alone. There are, you know, privacy is good and necessary. Privacy is also, it has its dangers and its risks. So the Christian needs to balance the privacy issue in life. And this is something you don't just set a policy and stick with it the rest of your life. This is a delicate balance. This is an area where there's times when your privacy, your space ought to be intruded into. When Jesus was trying to get away from the crowds and they apprehended him anyway, he didn't say, listen, I need my space, go away. It says he looked at them, he had compassion on them. They were like sheep without a shepherd, so he healed them and he fed them and he taught them when he would rather have been alone. That's what he's trying to be, is alone. But there are times when we must allow intrusion into our space as God's assignment. There's times when privacy has to be sacrificed, just like other desires have to be sacrificed. Just like we have to fast from food and we have to watch from sleep at times for the sake of the gospel, so also we have to sacrifice privacy from time to time, but not perpetually. If you sacrifice it perpetually, you will spiritually suffer for it. And even Jesus, as I say, could not live without his private, quiet time and solitary time with God. Now, having discussed the issue of privacy and not really come down with any ironclad rules for privacy, except you need to realize that you need it and you need to be aware of it. It is a necessary danger. If you are alone, there's no guarantee that you'll use the time to commune with God. You might use the time to have vain imaginations or entertain sinful thoughts or whatever, or watch a video that you'd never watch if anyone was around. You see, privacy is dangerous, but necessary. It's absolutely necessary that it be stewarded, that it be watched over, and that it be managed in a godly manner. And many are the Christians who have too little privacy and spiritually suffer, and others who have too much privacy, and others who have just enough privacy to get into trouble because they don't use privacy well. Now, let's talk about leisure. You might think that leisure and privacy are the same thing. They're not. Leisure time often is private time, but leisure time can also be spent with a group of people. Leisure is simply the time when you don't have any responsibilities to perform. You don't have any work that you have to do. And therefore, you have the opportunity to recreate. Or, in other words, recreational time. Recreation is a good word. It comes from the word creation, with the prefix re, like you recreate. It's like you restore. You get worn down through the responsibilities of life, and then you take time out to restore, to recreate what has been eroded. And I am in favor of people having leisure. All work and no play, you know, makes a jack a dull boy. But sometimes we can live in a culture where play overbalances work. You see, throughout most of history, the vast majority of history, the first 6,000 years of human history, most people, to survive, had to work with their hands in some profitable labor from sun up to sundown, 6, if you're Jewish, or if you weren't Jewish, 7 days a week. The Jews weren't only allowed to do it 6 days a week. God required them to take leisure. God required them to recreate 1 day of the week. Apart from that law, they would have been like everyone else. They would have worked 7 days a week. Life was for work, and work was for life, basically. It's so hard for us to put ourselves in the position to realize what was normative for people through thousands of years of history up until about 150 years ago. And that is that all work was manual. There was no automation. I mean, not much. They had the simple machines. They had an ox to pull the plow and things like that. But essentially all production of food and necessities, building a house, none of it was automated. It was all manual, and it was labor intensive. And leisure, it was just not really a part of most people's lives. What little it was after they fell into bed, exhausted, and they had a few moments to talk to their wife before they fell asleep. I mean, in many cases. Now, about 150 years ago, we have the beginning of the Industrial Revolution. You have the creation of the steam engine. You have the creation of other forms of engines. Eventually, you've got the internal combustion engine. As time goes on, you get nuclear power, and you've got electricity, and you've got, along with this comes higher forms of technology and labor-saving devices. And the woman doesn't have to go down to the creek and wash the clothes against a rocket anymore. She can just put them in the washer and go do something else. She doesn't have to labor over the stove for 4 hours to cook a meal for her family. She can just put it in the microwave and do something else. She's got leisure. And leisure is not always healthy. It's like privacy in the sense that it can be turned to good use, and some of it is necessary. But it can also be a very dangerous thing if it is not put to good use. And we live in a leisurely world. The average work week is shortening and shortening and shortening. It's, of course, currently around, for the average person, about 40 hours a week. That's an extremely short work week compared to what most human beings throughout history have had to do. And what do you do with the rest of the time? Well, some people are workaholics, and they take a second job or third job or whatever. But most people have leisure. I'm not saying that they know they have leisure. Sometimes the things they do in their leisure time is as stressful to them as working is, or maybe more so. But nonetheless, if you have time that is not spoken for, if it is elective time, if it is time that you have no responsibilities to fulfill during, then you have what we call leisure. It is for the leisure time, probably more than any other, that we must give an account to God. Because God can't really, He can't blame you for working at a job. I mean, everyone has to do that. But what you do in your leisure is what you do electively, what you choose to do. And a good or bad use of that time it definitely has ramifications for good or for evil. In Ephesians 5:16, Paul said that we should be redeeming the time because the days are evil. Now, frankly, I've always considered that to be an ambiguous expression, redeeming the time, but commentators all seem to agree that it means making the best use of the time. Redeem means to buy back. Apparently, there's all kinds of things claiming our time. Now, we need to buy back as much of it as we can for good purposes. We need to make the best use of time. This definitely has ramifications on our stewardship of the leisure time that we have. In Mark chapter 6, find her here. And verse 31, Mark 6, 31, Jesus said to them, "Come aside by yourselves to a deserted place and rest a while." It says, "For there were many coming and going, and they did not even have leisure to eat." It sounds like city life. Many people coming and going. But they were so busy with the crowds, they didn't have any leisure to eat. And so he says, "Come aside by yourselves to a deserted place. Let's get a little rest here." Jesus believed in having some time away from the responsibilities. Obviously, that's a privacy thing too. But they had no leisure. They needed to take some time out for themselves. Now, not for themselves, really. Because for the Christian, there is nothing really that is done for the sake of self. It's done for the sake of the kingdom of God. But God has concern about your emotional well-being too. God is concerned about your health. That's why he ordained a Sabbath day to the Jews, that they could take some time off, that they could get some rest, and that they could spend some time doing other things that are not so stressful and so energy consuming and so forth. And especially they could do things that were godly. They could direct more of their thoughts toward God, not so much toward making a living. Now, what are we to do with our leisure? Well, how much of your time do you personally really own? I mean, that you have, that you could say, this is my time for me. And what is the basis of your claim of ownership? How much of your time did you acquire for yourself by your own effort? Were you born by your own effort? Have you survived, did you survive childhood by your own effort? Does your heart keep beating every day by your own effort, or your lungs breathing? You know, it's interesting that Daniel said to Belshazzar, the king, you have honored all these different gods, but you have not honored the God in whose hand your breath is. Meaning, God is the one who gives you each breath. He can stop giving you breaths anytime he wants to. I was just talking to my wife last night about how many people there are my age, and I'm an old man, right? I'm 45 years old. But in the past couple years, I have had no fewer than 5 or 6 fairly close Christian friends about my age die of cancer or some other way. And it's a little bit amazing. You don't think of people in their 40s being at the end of their lifetime, but that's up to God, isn't it? I mean, we assume that we're entitled to a 60-year or 70-year lifetime. Somehow we think that we have some innate claim on the days and years of our life. We don't. Every moment we have, because we have one more breath. But if we don't have another breath after that, we don't have another moment. We pass from time into eternity. Now, God, therefore, is the one who gives the breaths. God is the one who gives us time. It is God, therefore, who owns the time. And we are His stewards, and we must use it as He would wish. This doesn't mean we can't ever have fun. It doesn't mean we can't ever just relax. That may be exactly what God wants you to do. As I said, the Sabbath commandment indicates that God has concern about relaxation. But at the same time, we have to realize that our own culturally conditioned idea of how much leisure we should have for ourselves, for recreation and so forth, may need to be examined simply in the light that we think of as normal that which we grew up with. You know, unless you went to summer school when you were growing up, you had 9 months out of the year where you had to do schoolwork. Then 3 months, what did you have to do? Well, a lot of nothing, usually. I mean, you might have gone to summer school, you might have had some chores your parents gave you, but for the most part, you had leisure. Did anyone get in trouble during the summertime? Any of you ever get in trouble? Well, I did. I did most of the worst things I've done in my life were done in the summertime when I was a kid. And that's because, what? I had nothing but leisure. I had leisure, I had no responsibilities, and yet people become acclimated to that much leisure, so when they get jobs, they want to have 3 weeks vacation with pay, increasing with the number of years you work for the company. You want more than that. You want to retire as early as possible. Why? What are you going to do when you retire? Go serve God in the mission field? Well, if so, that's a good reason to retire. But if it's so I can just have leisure, what? For the remaining 20, 30 years of your life, leisure? We have come to be a people who revere leisure and consider it to be our inalienable right, and we consider it intolerable to think of working a job where we'd have to work 6 days a week, or where we never get to retire, or where there's no paid vacation. It'd be unthinkable. Why? Not because it is cruel and unusual punishment. It is, in fact, the way human beings live for 6,000 years. It is because our culture has acclimated to us to expect a certain amount of leisure time. Now, I'll tell you something. If you can put leisure time to good use, then thank God that you live in a culture where leisure is still quite abundant. But I believe many Christians have not really learned how to put leisure to very good use. And that brings us to the next point, and that's the issue of entertainment. Because to a greater or lesser degree, most people, Christians included, use a lot of their leisure, maybe most of it, some cases all of it, on activities that they choose for the entertainment value of the activity. Now, what is entertainment? entertainment is stimulation of the senses, stimulation of the emotions in a, of a positive sort, which places low demands on our, you know, energies and low demands on our even thinking. We don't have to think hard. When we're being entertained, we can sort of put the mind in neutral and let something act upon our senses positively, we hope. I mean, to make us happy, make us feel good. Sometimes it's even entertaining to feel bad. I mean, watch a sad movie. But the thing is, entertainment is sort of what we do with leisure when we don't have anything profitable to do. And when we just want to not, we just kind of want to vegetate and let something else act upon our senses to make us feel good about the time spent. And I hope that doesn't sound like a real negative way of describing entertainment. Obviously, it's not extremely positive, but I do not oppose entertainment altogether. But we live in an entertainment age. We've been stimulated from early age. You know, when my children were very little, I was very poor. Benjamin, when he was a little boy, entertained himself with sticks and stones and empty paper bags, you know, that the groceries came home in, and he was as happy as a lark. Other kids I knew of other families, you know, they had these fancy, highly, brightly colored, noisy toys. And, you know, I don't say there's anything really evil about those toys, but you know what? Benjamin grew up in his youth not needing so much stimulation. We never even had a TV in the house. Now, in recent years, we've got a VCR. We have a VCR, but we don't have a TV. And a VCR can be just as bad, by the way. And by the way, I think we have used the VCR at times in ways that we have later regretted. And we thought, what's the difference between that and having a TV? You know, the purpose of a VCR technically is you're supposed to be able to control what comes into the home a little easier. It's easier to discipline yourself with a VCR. And also, there's no commercials, and a lot of times commercials are the most objectionable things on the television. So there's supposedly some advantage to having a VCR over having a TV from a Christian point of view. But even that can be a tremendous temptation and time waster. I'm not going to say Christians shouldn't have VCRs. I do have a fairly strong feeling against television, though I would not make a law about television since the Bible does not. I'm not saying every Christian who has a television is sinning by having one. That could not be the case. That is not the case. There are Christians stronger than I am, but not most. Most Christians are not stronger than I am. My experience was, the reason I don't have a television and never have had one is because every time I'm in the home of someone who has a television and it's on, I get sucked right into it. I'll be walking through the room, the TV's on, before long I'm sitting down, watching three shows in a row. It's mesmeric. It's hypnotic. I mean, this is not an accident, by the way. The people who write the shows, the people who write the commercials, these people are, they make their living, they make great fortunes knowing what scratches people where they itch, knowing what attracts people, knowing what is visually stimulating, know how many times they have to change the scene in order to keep the attention, knowing how to put just enough nakedness on the screen to get, you know, to still be able to be on TV but still arouse the evil senses of the viewer. There's just, I mean, they have psychologists on their advisory board telling them what, you know, what makes people tick and how do you get to them. I mean, TV. You know, sometimes people say, well, you know, we shouldn't complain about all the violence on TV. What's on TV is just reflective of society and it doesn't have any impact on people anyway. That's ridiculous, of course. Everyone knows TV has impact. There are heroes. There are role models. I mean, no one who has children could ever dream of honestly saying TV has no impact on behavior. Now, my kids never watch Saturday morning cartoons because we don't have a TV. But the kids I know who do, man, they're imitating who? The Power Rangers or whoever's on TV. I don't know who it is, but I mean, you tell me this doesn't influence them? They have these heroes, they imitate them, they role play. These people set their behavior standards for them. And don't think this isn't true of adults as well. In measure it is. Less so than with children, but still very much so. You get bombarded with the messages of the culture. I mean, even if what you're watching has no immorality and no blasphemy directly in it, watching program after program after program that are supposed to be typical life settings, family life, work life at the job, you know, the network news life, or whatever, you know, some kind of, you know, a focal point on some industry that's always the setting for the sitcom or whatever. When you see what's portrayed as real life again and again and again and again, and there's no reference to God in any of it, and then occasionally there is, but it's always mocking God or mocking decency. But if you say, oh, I'm not going to watch those programs that mock God, so you'll just watch all the programs that portray normal life as secular. Normal life is a life without God. If you think that has no effect, I think you're deceiving yourself. But you know, many times people say, well, I watch TV, but it doesn't affect me. It should. It should disgust you. It should outrage you. Christians, I can't think of anything that's on TV now that is uniformly safe for Christian consumption. Even the nature programs are shot through with worship of nature, animal rights, evolutionary assumptions and statements. I mean, where do you find something on TV that is uniformly safe? You might say, well, what about the Christian TV stations? My point exactly. The most dangerous stations to watch of all, because they portray what masquerades as Christianity. You know, if you watch secular TV, at least you can say, well, those are heathens. I don't think that way. I'm a Christian. That's heathenism. Boy, am I glad I'm not like that. You watch the TV station that's Christian, and you can't, you know, but this is Christianity? These people are Christians? Is this what I'm part of? It can be very depressing, I'll tell you. I can't think of any good reason for a Christian to have a TV in the home. Do you know why TV exists? You think it's for entertainment? No, it's not for entertainment. It's to create covetousness. TV exists because of commercials. Now you might say, well, I watch public television. Well, even it exists for covetousness. First of all, there are commercials. They just have them at the end of the program, and they don't have as much stimulation in the commercials. But they tell you who it is that you should be paying back for giving you the programming, as it were. But commercial TV, which is far more common, is commercial TV. A commercial is there to tell you that what you have isn't good enough. What they're selling is what you need. And therefore, to inspire covetousness. If they cannot make you covetous, they can't make any money. And believe me, they know how to make you covetous, so they spend billions of dollars on advertising, and they don't do that because TV has no effect on people's behavior. They do that because TV is known to have effect on behavior, and the particular effect the commercials have is to make you feel like you need so many things that you don't need, and particularly the things they have. You might even have a good toothpaste already, but their toothpaste will give you sex appeal. Yours doesn't. You need theirs. And that is what television exists for, is for covetousness. Well, what about the programming? Isn't that sometimes interesting and entertaining? Yes, sometimes it is. That's what keeps you glued to the tube between the commercials. The programming exists to hold your attention between commercials, to give you an excuse for watching so that you can see the commercials. But TV is not a godly thing. I'm not saying there are only ungodly people out there. There are Christian actors. There are even Christians who have Christian shows on Christian programming who are probably godly Christians. But the vast majority of it is so rank that I can't understand why a Christian would ever want one in his home. Now, some say, well, I just watch the news. Well, that's between you and God. I'm not so sure I want the news from that angle. I'd rather know the truth if I was going to spend the time. But television, videos, these are common forms of entertainment. Today, of course, there's video games. Most of them are absolutely unfit for Christian consumption. You know, they're just stimulation. Some of it of the worst kind, tearing people's heads off, you know, women wearing almost nothing in kick fights with thugs and so forth. I mean, or maybe it's not that kind of corruption. Maybe it's just the excitement of being in a race car and getting your blood rolling. My son and I went to the Ministerial Association in Bend to talk about something the other day. And in the pizza parlor where it was, there was this video game that I let my son do because it was like a car. You know, you've seen them. You know, you sit behind a wheel and you have a gas pedal and stuff and you've got this screen and you're driving a race car. And man, I was standing there behind him watching the screen. I was about ready to fall over. I thought, well, I better get seatbelted in here because it was so real. It feels like you're there. It's not virtual reality, but it's close in terms of its effect. And I was thinking, this is getting my son used to the idea of fast driving. Now, listen, I'll tell you what, I'm kind of a fast driver. My wife always tells me to slow down. But I know something. Fast driving is stimulating. It gives you a rush. And you become acclimated to a degree of stimulation that when it is taken from your experience, you become bored. This is my main concern about entertainment. Well, there's more than one concern. One is the actual content of the entertainment. The entertainment is a means of subtly and not so subtly getting anti-Christian messages into the populace. There's no question about that. But additional to that, even if you avoid those forms of entertainment that are overtly anti-Christian, there's another whole factor to be concerned with. The Bible says, he that has no rule over his own spirit is like a city broken down and without walls. And your spirit, your spiritual climate begins to be manipulated by the stimulation and the rush and the excitement and so forth. And you might say, well, what's wrong with that? Is that really sinful? No, not in itself. The problem is the addiction. The problem is the level that you become accustomed to, without which you feel bored. And this, I believe, it's like a drug. I believe entertainment is very much like a drug, this kind of stimulation, because you start with a light drug, eventually the drug doesn't get you as high as it used to. You're just too acclimated. You need to get something a little stronger, take higher dosages and so forth. Eventually you're on some pretty bad stuff. Entertainment's the same way. You know, you start watching G-rated movies, Disney kids movies. By the way, they're all corrupt. They're full of witchcraft and immorality and so forth anyway. But the thing is, you start out in what you consider safe movies. And there's a little excitement. It stimulates you. You get laughing. You get excited. You get concerned about the bear who looks like he's dead, but he woke up afterwards and everyone's happy at the end. It's all the music, the images, the color. It all manipulates your emotions. Eventually, that's kind of boring. Let's go to something else. Let's go to something where there's a chase scene in every movie. Cars chasing each other through the traffic. People jump out of the way. Oh, that's a lot of fun. And that, no one can say that's not Christian to watch that kind of stuff, right? But it raises the ante. It raises the level of stimulation that you now are not bored with. Eventually, you want to see those slasher flicks, because nothing short of that, everything else is humdrum. And the slasher flicks have simulated death. Once you get to that point, that can become dull. Then you need the actual hit flicks. Then you need the actual movies smuggled in from Mexico where they actually killed someone on screen. I mean, I'm not saying everyone goes through this stage. Obviously, Christians have to cut off somewhere, and some of them cut off in a much safer place than that. But it's like a drug. A certain amount of stimulation works for a while. But after it doesn't work for a while, you got to get more. Or else you got to repent of it and go back and start from square one again and say, what have I been doing with my brain? Entertainment is the stewardship of your mind. It has to do with the stewardship of your mind. And you know, you can find entertainment. I know this from experience. You can find entertainment in loving God and reading the Word of God and fellowship with other Christians. There is nothing more enjoyable in the world to someone who loves God than these things. And the things that you choose to entertain you might be more of a barometer of your spirituality than a determiner of it. Of course, it'll have some effect, too, in determining future spirituality. But what you choose to do with your leisure and the things you find enjoyable, they tell you more about yourself than you may think. And it is a barometer of spirituality. Some of the old Christian mystics used to say that a person who has the least inside requires the most outward stimulation, but the person who has the most inward joy, the most inward relationship with God, lacks the desire for entertainment more. I'm not opposed to all entertainment, but I'll tell you what, in the early days of my Christian life, I was so busy, so full of the Lord, so enjoying fellowship, I didn't see any movies for 10 years. Not because I had a rule, thou shalt not go see movies. I just didn't want to. I didn't have any interest in it. I was too stimulated with the things of God. I was too entertained and finding enjoyment with the things of God. And those were things that I don't mind my mind being given to. You know what Paul said about the mind? I'm sure most Christians know this. In Philippians chapter 4, he said, whatsoever things, in Philippians 4, 8, finally, brethren, whatsoever things are true, whatever things are noble, whatever things are just, whatever things are pure, whatever things are lovely, whatever things are of good report, if there's any virtue and if there's anything praiseworthy, meditate on these things. The man who doesn't wither, according to Psalm 1, is the man who meditates day and night on the Word of God. Many Christians wither today, but there's not many meditating day and night on the Word of God. You know why? So much entertainment available. Too much leisure, poorly managed, Too much entertainment, too much stimulation. Meditating on the Word of God, that's dull. Didn't used to be. But the level of stimulation we've become acclimated to has ruined us in many cases for quiet enjoyment of God and of spiritual things. And let me encourage you to backtrack if you've already gone past that point. And limit your choices in entertainment, being aware of these tendencies. That's a very essential.